From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
APRS, Joel, Automatic Packet Reporting System.
Indeed.
I actually hear people calling it APERS, which just makes my teeth grind to powder, let me tell you. APERS.
That's interesting. I guess I'm wondering, I never thought about trying to pronounce that, but I guess it would work, especially since it has no vowels in it. I guess it has one in the beginning. Maybe that works. Maybe that's enough.
Well, to talk about APRS, we actually have to make a little diversion and talk about packet radio.
That's true. You know, I guess a lot of people starting out in the last, 15 years or so, 20 years, I don't know when, may not have encountered packet radio. And I guess, I was thinking about it on the way over this morning, that packet radio kind of lost out to the internet, I think.
Yes.
Back in the, 70s, we used to have, and maybe into 80s, I'm not sure exactly when the transition happened, but a very common communications mode from most ham stations, sort of parallel to other things that were going on, was packet radio. Typically on 2 meters, you had either a dumb terminal or a somewhat smarter, but not as smart as today's computers, emulating a dumb terminal, talking to a terminal node controller, which did all the heavy lifting, and then interchanged packets using AX25 protocol, which was a variation of the X.25 commercial data interchange protocol designed for amateur use. And you basically sent packets on 2 meters to typically a packet node. There would be some station would be set up, and everybody would talk to it on a simplex frequency basis. And you'd send messages back and forth, just text messages kind of thing. And they would store and forward, and they'd wait for you to sign on and get your message when you were on the network. But there were a lot of things going on. There were bulletin boards and other kinds of nodes. So it sort of served the purpose, DX cluster kind of thing. You could get DX reports like we get on the internet now.
There's some of those still around.
I'm sure there's nothing that would make them stop working except people losing interest in favor of the internet, which can do many other things. But there were lists of used equipment, and you could just do all kinds of stuff. And typically everybody had this sort of running, or many hams had this running in the background. As I say, nowadays, most of those functions show up on internet-connected device using a browser that can do many other things as well.
Yes.
This was strictly a low bandwidth, typically 300 bit per second kind of thing, using telephone modem-type technology through this terminal node controller.
Up on 2 meters, they ran 1,200 bits per second.
Sorry, high speed.
Yes, high speed. Some experimented with 9,600 baud packet at
the time.
There
were some backbone interconnections that
is true. The 1980s were really the heyday of that.
And that's really when the internet came into being, and it really, once browsers became popular and everybody had that running also, at least at my station, I stopped being interested in that. I used to have an old IBM PC dedicated to this, acting like a terminal with its 5 1/4 inch floppy drives that brought up the operating system, and another one that had the terminal node or terminal emulator software. So it was a very popular thing back then.
Yes. Now, of course, in the early 1990s, as we inch our way toward the present day, Bob Berninga, WB4APR, started taking those terminal node controllers, those devices that create the packets that you can send out over your FM radio, and married them to global positioning system receivers so that the data from the receiver, the location data, could be fed into the packets and then sent out over the air and shared. And that was just the beginning of APRS, really.
Absolutely right. I just connected that his call letters are the first 3 letters of APRS.
Why, of course.
A strange coincidence.
Well, he's trademarked APRS. He actually owns the trademark to that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he's quite an interesting guy and has a lot of other interests, including solar power and other things. He's written quite a few articles for QST. But what basically happened is this has gotten more tightly integrated. So now you can get little devices that do GPS and packet node controlling in one little box. And in fact, you can now get radios from a number of manufacturers that have all of that built in. So they have perhaps a microphone that has an antenna on it that receives GPS, or maybe the GPS is built into the body of the radio. And the radio typically sends out the position report on a frequency of 144.39 megahertz throughout the U.S. In other countries, they have other standard frequencies, but pretty much throughout U.S. is that one. And this data can be received and also retransmitted by any other stations that are operating on that frequency. Of course, they have to be equipped to deal with the data. But it also ends up in node locations that actually put the data out on various websites. You can actually, you don't have to have a radio to see APRS position reports.
That's
in your
right.
region. You can look at a map and see different symbols, cars, houses, and so forth. So people actually have a APRS node in their house, which can tell the world where the house is. Well, that's kind of interesting, but you'll notice most of them have more information, and that's, I guess, a key thing is that not only do they have position information, but they can be used to send other information. So you'll see weather data, other kinds of things. You can get weather reports from all over from people who have APRS nodes at their house and a weather data collection arrangement. Or you can also use it as a text sending device, so it can send interchange
yes.
text data.
Yeah, a lot of people aren't aware that you can send text messages by APRS. In fact, it's possible to send APRS text messages to and from the internet if you know how to format it correctly, and assuming that there is an APRS station connected to the internet that actually hears your signal.
Well, that's good. It also can be used, interestingly, and Bob wrote an article about this some time back, as an alert system to talk to other mobile stations. So to improve mobile FM communications, your APRS-equipped transmitter can be set to beacon with a 100 hertz CTCSS tone. Now, this won't interfere with the normal APRS traffic, but if you have a squelched receiver in your car set to 144.39, and have the CTCSS set to only open with 100 hertz, you'll get a blast from any car that's nearby that's equipped that way.
I've done that. That's pretty cool.
And in that way, you can monitor the channel without having to listen to the packet data itself, which is kind of dull if you're just listening to the tones. You'd much rather see the information in some other way. But in this way, you know that there's a car within direct communication range that's set up on 144.39. And what you can do is then call that station and establish a voice contact there. And then you should switch off onto another frequency, a working frequency, so that the APRS data can continue to interchange appropriately. So there are other things that happen. Making use of this, there are a lot of applications that make sense. I sold a piece of gear to someone who had an APRS-equipped car some 10 years ago. And he was coming up from Maryland to Connecticut, and I could watch his progress on the internet.
Yeah, what is the website? Is Find You, FIND, the letter U, findyou.com, I think, if I'm not mistaken?
There are actually a number of them, and that's one. So you can do an internet search on GPS data, or I'm sorry, APRS data, and you'll find some. The one I found that was kind of useful was WPRS.fi. Seemed to work well. But there are a couple of others that you can use. So
there's also a smartphone app. I have one on my iPhone, and it's called OpenAPRS.
Ah.
And it does a unique thing. It taps into the network so you can see the people who are transmitting APRS beacons on 144.39. At the same time, though, you can trigger the app to send your position using the GPS receiver in the phone. It sends it out to the internet, and that way it's also shared with everybody else.
Oh.
So it's becoming APRS as a network increasingly shared or integrated with the internet itself.
Interesting. And of course, there are a lot of things. You can make use of the position data, and people have done and for various reasons. You can monitor people who are doing things on the water, or particularly balloon launch people are very active with this, because there's nothing like knowing where the balloon comes down to be able to find it. It's pretty easy to see when they're up in the air, but when they
yes.
land, it's hard to tell where they are.
Well, Joel, let's take a break for
okay.
DX Engineering, and we'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
All right, and we're back. More about APRS, in particular, the type of equipment. You mentioned, and you're quite right, of course, that there are radios that already have APRS capability built in. By that, I mean they have the GPS receiver, they have the terminal node controller in there to format the packets and send them. I've seen this in handhelds, mobile transceivers, and whatnot. If you don't have an APRS equipped transceiver, then you would need obviously a GPS receiver if you're going to be using it mobile. And again, a terminal node controller of some kind, or a tracker, correct? A little tracker module?
Yeah, there are people that have integrated all this into a small device. The terminal node controllers of the old days were relatively substantial. Nowadays, there are specialized integrated little devices that perform the function with just a few chips, and they are in a small box, and they can connect directly to the radio and directly to the GPS, and the whole package can be quite compact and not take up a lot of room in your vehicle.
It's also important to point out that if all you care about is monitoring APRS activity, you don't need a GPS receiver. You just need an FM rig, some sort of terminal node controller to translate that packet audio into data that your computer can use, and then some way to display it on your monitor. And that's kind of the rub. There you need not only APRS software, but the software has to have a way to display maps, map data. And if it isn't integrated in the software, then that's yet something else that you need to add.
Yeah, and some of the radios that have built-in capability have a screen that actually shows the data right on the screen.
That's
true.
You
can see text, you can see position data, and so forth. But if you don't know lat long in your head,
that would be problematic. That's true. One of the most common APRS packages is actually kind of old, as software goes. It was written by the late Roger Barker, G4IDE, and it's called UIView. That's UI-View. And it's now free on the internet. You can do a Google search and you can download it. But it does require you to integrate maps of some kind, either something from Garmin, or in his case, there is a precision mapping. That's a map software company. Precision mapping server that you can put in there that'll bring up really detailed maps to show you where everything is.
And of course, if you don't want to go through all that, you can just use one of these internet locations and look at maps that are provided and see the data that gets to the internet, which may not be all the data that's going around in your neighborhood, but it should be most of it.
You bring up a good point. And also, as you had mentioned earlier, but it needs to be reinforced, if Bob were here talking to us, I'm sure he would jump in and say, APRS is more than about watching where things are or watching where things are moving. That might have been the purpose when it initially got started, but now it really does a lot more. As you point out, the mobile application, mobile signaling, if you will, the messaging functions, all of that. It's a much broader network than most people give it credit for.
That's right. Well, you can use whatever part of it you find of interest or helpful to you, but there are a lot of parts.
That's true. Well, Joel, would you like a question while we're
sure,
at it?
Sure, we can try that.
Okay, well, Bob, WA2SQQ, asks, I'd like to ask your opinion on an idea I had last night about how I might create a 75-meter antenna that is more broadbanded than the inverted V I'm presently using. Multiband dipoles operate on the principle of multiple links of wire, each resonant at different frequencies. Could I build a dipole using ladder line as the elements and cut one side for the low end of 75 and the other side for the high end of 75? would these two parallel wires effectively act as two separate antennas and extend the usable bandwidth?
Well, that would be nice. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work that way, and it doesn't actually work any better, really, than just having two wires the same length sort of in mid-band. The reason for that is that the two parallel dipoles operate on the assumption that the dipole that's not currently in use offers a very high impedance at the frequency you're using so that it doesn't accept power, and the power just goes into the one that you want. And on the other band, the opposite is true. And that works well for antennas that are on widely different frequencies, like an 80 and 40 meter dipoles, for example, can work that way. Not that there aren't some issues with coupling and so forth, and the further apart they are, generally the easier it is to make them work, but they can be made to work even at close spacings if you spend time fiddling with them. If the frequencies are too close together, that underlying assumption is not met, and what happens is the power essentially divides between the two wires, and so it doesn't really act like two separate antennas. It acts like one thick antenna, which will actually make it somewhat broader bandwidth than if it didn't have that. You can actually get two resonances from the conditions, but the higher frequency has a very narrow response and an SWR of about 3:1 in my experience. The same is true, by the way, of my two-band coupled resonator dipole that I described in QST. It doesn't work on 75 and 80 either. Just to give an example of what we're talking about here, a single-wire dipole made of number 14 AWG wire at a height of 75 feet has a 50-ohm 2:1 SWR bandwidth of about 150 kilohertz centered around its resonance. And at that height, it happens to have an impedance of about 75 ohms. So what that means is to cover all of 80 meters, you need at least three separate antennas at 150 kilohertz each, or some other way to deal with the mismatch of being off the edges of them. An antenna tuner can take care of that too. By using the wires of window line both the same length and mid-band, it acts like a single thicker wire, and the thicker the wire, the wider the bandwidth, and the bandwidth then increases to about 250 kilohertz. So it's a little less than twice as wide band as a single wire. So that's not a bad thing. It also tends to lower the center frequency about 100 kilohertz, so you have to be aware of that. But it also has a 1:1 SWR resonance. So it makes an improvement, but it doesn't particularly make an improvement to have them set for different frequencies. Now you can carry that further by using the two separate wires, not window line, but separate wires as a fan dipole, with the ends 2 feet apart. The 2:1 bandwidth can be extended to about 300 kilohertz. Well, that can cover the phone band, for example, and that's with an SWR of 3:1 across the whole band. The antenna needs to be about 10 feet shorter, which can be helpful also. You can carry that further. At W1AW, we use a four-wire cage antenna. The four wires are all connected in parallel at the ends, and they're about 4 feet apart on spreaders that are in a sort of an X configuration made out of PVC tubing, and it covers the whole 80-meter band very nicely, including 75 and 80. There are other solutions. An elegant design of a three-wire combination folded dipole and coupled resonator dipole by Rudy Severns, N6LF, was shown in the February 2015 Doctor column. It's only 1 foot wide and can cover all of 75 and 80 meters, with some left over for Mars frequencies. It's not directly coax fed. It's fed with window line and then a 9:1 balun to coax, and it'll cover the whole band without a tuner and on 50 ohms at that bottom of the balun. An even simpler approach was described by Frank Witt, AI1H, in the September 1993 issue of QST. This used a single wire dipole cut for mid-band and fed with two lengths of coax of different characteristic impedance. There are a number of coax lengths that combinations that he described, depending on the distance from the antenna to the station. So there are a number of ways of skinning this cat. Unfortunately, the way you propose is not completely feasible, but all is not lost if you use one of those other solutions.
Sounds great to me. Thank you.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time. I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.